Les colloques du Collège de France.
Thank you for being here, of course, at first, and I'm honored, and it's an honor and a pleasure to be here. It's also highly intimidating, but I think I'm not the only one being intimidated by such an amazing number of speakers. I was first introduced to the work of Stan by Manuela Piazza, who was my professor in Trento back then, and when I read the number sense, I was like, okay, I want to work in numerical cognition, but I didn't dare to send an email to Stan, so I literally sent something like 25 emails to a lot of people working in numerical cognition in Europe. Most of them ghosted me, they didn't reply. Some of them said, no, I cannot. And eventually I said, okay, let's give it a shot. I sent an email to Stan, it worked, and I've been doing a lot of things with him. I did my master's, my PhD, my postdoc with him. Some people might think it's an example of Stockholm syndrome. I swear I haven't been kidnapped by him, so it's because I wanted to be and to be with him. And of course, we had already said a lot of qualities of Stan. Just let me tell you one, since I passed through all the stages with him. My academic career is basically with him. I can tell that it doesn't matter if you are a master's student or a PhD or a professor or a Nobel Prize, he will treat you the same way, which is great, I think, because it's something so rare in an environment like academia with hierarchies really important and really present for a lot of people. And Stan doesn't do that. You are at first a colleague, a collaborator in the quest of truth and for the beauty of science. So thank you, Stan, for this, really. All right, so I try to be fast because I know that we are running late. And today I'm going to talk about what we've been working on during these past years, which is the perception of and understanding of patterns and graphics, the kind of graphics we've been seeing all over these presentations, these wonderful presentations these days. But I have to tell that graphicacy, which is the ability to understand graphs, is very much a neglected cultural skill. And is very much neglected if compared to literacy and numeracy. We've been listening to wonderful talks about reading and arithmetics and computations, but we don't know much about graphs. And in fact, if we take a close look, we can see that graphs, written words, and numbers are really sharing something deep. They all are a product of human culture. They all are symbolic representations. They all are based on shared conventions, both in terms of semantics and syntax. They are based on the visual channel to transmit complex information, and they are usually taught at school, and they require considerable learning experience. But again, as I said, graphicacy is kind of neglected. First of all, it's neglected by the general population. We ask several people to answer very simple questions, such as, what's the number of children who preferred cats? Or, for example, if X increases, does Y increase as well? And well, we find that up to 20-25% of the general population cannot know how to answer these questions, which is kind of astonishing if you compare to basic knowledge in numeracy or literacy. And also, it's been neglected by the school system. We are kind of changing that thanks to the amazing program Pionier de Math. But the idea is that if we look at old French math textbooks, at least the most used one, and on average, below 2% of all lessons are dedicated to graphics. But if you look at TIMSS or PISA assessments, up to 20% of the questions are based on graphics. So it's even unfair to say that probably we are bad if, in fact, most questions are asking something that children have not been exposed to. And this is even sadder, I think, if we see, as we all know, that graphics seems to even help memorizing information. So in a very simple experiment, we presented the same information in four different formats, either as text, tables, or graphics, and 2 hours later, surprise task, we asked participants to recall what they read. And crucially, we wrote the sentences in the test phase exactly in the same way that were presented in the text condition. So the text people should be the one remembering more, but in fact, this is not the case. People who read graphics are way better compared to people in other condition. So given all this, our research goal has been to investigate both the cognitive and neural basis of graphical perception using a psychophysical approach. So applying the same kind of approach that has been successfully applied to reading and numeracy to graphical perception. So at the beginning, we wanted to study the perceptual level. So we designed a very simple trend judgment. As you can see here, there's a scatter plot flashing on screen. You simply have to tell as fast as you could if it goes up or down. And as you can see at the bottom, we've arrived at a number number of parameters, such as the number of points, the noise, the slope, and all this gives you a t-value, right? When you are a statistician or a researcher, you want to know how confident you can be in the regression you're finding, and this is the t-value. So of course it varies depending on all these parameters. So you are like, can we find that performance of participants is closely predicted by this? And I don't want to show off, but it's kind of rare to see these almost perfect psychophysical curves. The performance of participants in this task is almost entirely predicted by the t-value. It looks like participants are being optimal statisticians. And again, as Manuela was saying before, not everything, of course, is shaped by culture, so we might wonder whether even populations that don't know what a graph is would behave similarly. Of course, they make more mistakes, the HIMBA, as Manuela described, they don't have access to formal schooling, but still behave in the same way, and same thing for French 6-year-old children. All these participants' performance is predicted by the t-value. They seem to be optimal statisticians when it comes to extract a trend from noisy data sets. And of course, for each participant, if you have such a curve, you can take the slope of this curve and it gives you a measure of the sensitivity in this task, so how good you are in this task. And this ability widely varies in the general population, and it's strongly correlated with statistical knowledge, but not, for example, with linguistic knowledge. And it also depends on the field in which we graduated. So the psychologists here, we are in the middle defending ourselves, but we're not necessarily the best. So again, trend judgment, despite looking really perceptual, seems to be intertwined with math knowledge. Culture seems still to play a role, and it's reminiscent, I think, of the number sense, right? At the beginning, I read many people in the oldest papers saying, yeah, but this is all perceptual, nothing to do with high-level math. Well, that's not the case. We found eventually that it is shaped by culture. And just for the fun of it, we also replicated this in baboons, and we found that, with some notable exceptions that you can read in the paper, they do behave like humans in a human-like way, with some of them, such as Violette, performing even better than many humans. I'm always afraid that eventually in 20 years I will discover that some of the co-authors was Violette, and so it's gonna be a fraud, this article. Hopefully not, it's a real baboon. But it shows that at least this ability is evolutionary old. We can extract the trends from a noisy data set, and we do so across species in a very similar manner. And just to tell you one thing, this perception is biased. When we ask participants to adjust the line on the scatter plot, we find that people tend to overestimate such a regression depending on the level of noise and the number of points. And this is not what should be done if you do ordinary least square regression, because if you minimize the vertical distance of the points to the fit, this gives you an unbiased estimator. It shouldn't be affected by noise or number of points. This is not the case for Deming regression. As in humans, in Deming regression, when we minimize the orthogonal distance of the points to the fit, these parameters play a role. So next time you see a scatter plot and you wonder why you thought there was a higher regression that you can see in your OLS, well, now you know why. You're probably biased. You think it's steeper than it is, probably because we behave like Deming regression. All right, so after these behavioral studies, we wanted to know what happens in the brain, of course, the neural basis of graph perception. And to do so, we designed a task with many runs. I'm gonna only focus on some of them. As you can see there on the left, it's a weird scatter plot because it has triangles and squares inside. So sometimes we ask participants to do a proportion estimation task, whether there are more triangles or squares, and some other times they do a graph-based task. Does it go up or down? So it's the same stimuli all the time, I mean, varying, of course, for the low-level features, but sometimes it's a non-graph task, and sometimes it's a graph-based task. Also some objects, whether it's a kitchen tool or not, whether it goes up or down, and some classic Pinel localizer, as we call it, math language localizer. The results are here. I think the main thing to keep in mind is that we find that the same areas, such as the LOC and the PATG, that are activated for detecting the orientation of objects are also activated for detecting the orientation of graphs, which is probably a novel example, again, of cultural recycling. But crucially, graphs are not just objects. So at least in our sample, who were all made, you know, of STEM students, so people who know what graph is, also the IPS is activated, so the classic math network. So based on these behavioral and neural results, we propose we stand a sort of two steps model, according to which at first there's a sort of perceptual processing the graph is treated like any other object. We extract the convex hull, probably the main axis, and then for people who know what the graph is, culture play a role, and so we might wonder whether there are outliers, if some other trends are present, and so we treat this as a mathematical object. Of course, we need to test that, especially the temporal resolution of it, but this is a first step. We can also go beyond linearity. So far, there were just, you know, linear trends. Can human go beyond that? If I show you something like this, I'm sure most of you are not afraid of this. I still have math anxiety, so I'm afraid of these ways of presenting math. But if I show you the same data in this way, it's not frightening anymore. You can see how they behave. And in fact, when we ask participants to adjust the point to make an extrapolation of the best continuation of these curves, which is a work kind of similar to also what some of the PhD students of Josh Tenenbaum have been doing, you can see that, in fact, participants are quite good, with the exception of quadratic. You can see there the blue plots. They are not really behaving well. They seem to linearize the tendency to underestimate the acceleration. It was COVID time. We were at home, confined at home. So we were like, OK, quadratic is cool, but there's another example of accelerating function which is very poorly understood in the general population, which, of course, are exponential functions. So we ask the same kind of task. We ask participants to extrapolate either by a numerical guess, so estimate what's going to be the number at this time point, or by pointing, by adjusting a point. And again, at least for noisy functions, we find an underestimation. So the green line here, it's the responses of subjects. In both conditions, subjects tend to underestimate. And this underestimation correlates, again, with math knowledge. So this task is, in fact, a task that even my grandmother, if she was there, could be able to do, because she can point to a continuation of a graph. But mathematical knowledge seems to refine or change the way we see this. And just a small note, when there's no noise in the function, when the exponential is pure, the bias is normal there. So maybe that could be a good suggestion for data visualization practitioners to probably avoid presenting noise, because as soon as there's noise, there seems to be a sort of prior against exponentials, and so we underestimate. And to conclude, we wanted to be a little crazy and ask the same questions in children, in 5 years old and 6 years old. Of course, we cannot ask them to extrapolate or make a numerical guess because it's kind of complex, they wouldn't know how to perform. And so we decided with my colleagues to use drawing. They love drawings. Teachers think it's a very much useful activity for creativity, for writing. So we were like, OK, let's try a bunch of possible functions. This is just a subset of what we tested, exponential functions, linear functions. You can see sinusoids varying in cycle length, different increase or decrease in amplitude. Here is an example of all the scanned images, one on the other, of all child's response. You can see the subjects are really distinguishing between the functions. When it's a linear function, they go straight. Some kids go crazy, but on average, when it's quadratic or exponential, they understand there's a curve, there's an acceleration. Reviewer 2, because it's always reviewer 2, in the paper say, yeah, but that could be just motor entrainment. They could be just entrained in their motor program, which to me is not a huge critique, because even if it was a motor program, we have to explain how the motor program has an innate or something inside as a function, but we rule out the motor hypothesis by testing it with the detection task, in which the multiple choice task, the child has to select the correct function. So it's not a motor phenomenon. As I showed you before, sinusoids with different cycles lengths, and kids can distinguish between them, so they will prolong with a longer period functions that have a longer period, and they will prolong with a smaller period functions that have a smaller period. And here, Fosca was talking about compositionality before. We think that this kind of stimuli are pretty nice for studying compositionality because we can actually combine different functional aspects together. So here you have a periodic pattern, but the amplitude could decrease or stay constant or increase. So you can kind of play with this. There are two functional aspects together. Is the kid able to do both, to understand that he has to combine both aspects? And in fact, they can. So they can distinguish between functions that are decreasing in amplitude, staying constant, or increasing in amplitudes at both ages. 5 years old, so it's even the beginning of formal schooling. All right, so I will almost conclude. I'm in the 15 minutes. I'm very proud of myself. Sorry if I spoke too fast. This is my Italian side. I hope I convinced you that humans, independently from age, education and culture, and probably even non-humans, such as, you know, baboons so far, rely on the t-value when performing trend judgments over noisy scatter plots. So they seem to be intuitive statisticians, but the sensitivity in such a task correlates with math knowledge. So of course it's something perceptual, something probably evolutionarily very old, but as soon as we learn graphs, this becomes more refined, very similar to what happened to the number sense. Judging trends in noisy graphics recycle brain areas that are devoted to object orientation detection. So it's an example of probably neural cultural recycling, but also elicits the activation of the math network, because a graph is not just an object like any other, it's a special object, it's a math object, it's a cultural object. Human extrapolation abilities extend to nonlinear functions, but not to accelerating ones, at least when there's noise. So when there's no noise, maybe we do have the correct primitive in our mind, we do have a nice catalog of functions, but as soon as there's noise, especially for exponential, we tend to underestimate, and we do even more so if we are not that knowledgeable in math. And lastly, I show you that probing, prolonging mathematical functions for drawing seems a promising method to investigate very young children's ability to represent functional relationships. It's kind of hard to do the classic psychophysical task in children, but with drawing, probably we found a way. They were able to do our task for like 30 minutes or 45 minutes straight because it's something they enjoy, and this allowed us to study very hard questions such as, for example, compositionality, which is, you know, very hard to tackle. So we think drawing might be a good way to start this. And with this, I thank you for your attention.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.